Welcome to Podcast One. We hope you'll support our sponsors who bring you these podcasts absolutely free and with limited interruptions. And of course, we appreciate you listening to this show, which will get started in just a second.
The following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
From Hollywood, California, by way of the Broken Skull Ranch, this is the Steve Austin Show.
Give me a hell yeah.
Hell yeah.
Now, here's Steve Austin.
All right, everybody, welcome to the Steve Austin Show. I'm coming to you from the main streets of Los Angeles, California today. I'm over here at 316 Gimmick Street. Yep, the old switcheroo. Putting a coat of paint on the exterior of 317, the studio. So I am sitting here at my kitchen table trying not to echo too much because we haven't got our rugs down. Today I got Marty Scurll from Ring of Honor and New Japan Pro Wrestling. He came by the crib after the New Japan shows in Long Beach a week or so ago to talk about the business of the squared circle and how he got into wrestling growing up in England. And you're going to hear what it's like working on the indie scene, how he hooked up with New Japan and Ring of Honor, and all the crazy things that inspired his gimmick, the villain. He's got some interesting ideas about in-ring psychology and the state of the business today. But before we get into my conversation with Marty Scurll, I bring in my illustrious wife, Kristen, who is sitting right next to me. Kristen, welcome to the Steve Austin Show. How are you today? It's Monday.
I'm actually sitting across the table from you.
How are you?
I'm doing well.
It was an interesting weekend. We went down to Sparks, Nevada to see my brother-in-law, Kristen's brother, and our nieces, and had a hell of a damn good time down there looking around for... just kind of kicking around some property. I don't know that we'll end up in Nevada, but we looked. And then coming back, it was hotter than blazes. We came through part of the desert, probably Mojave, Kristen, when it hit 115 degrees.
Yep, there are lots of cars on the side of the road with blown out tires.
I think those RVs sit so much sometimes they get dry rot. And boy, all of a sudden, man, it's 113, 115.
Well, that pavement's got to be blazing.
Oh, yeah, but you're on the side of the road changing a flat tire. That is not something I want to do. So next time we drive the RV down there, we might need to get the tires changed on that damn thing because I don't need no blowout changing a flat tire in the desert in 115 degrees temperature, and it's only July. It ain't even August yet.
Is it supposed to get hotter?
Well, it should be. I know we're in a heat wave. I was just reading this article in the computer today on my MSN homepage talking about the end of civilization, probably within the century, whatever it's talking about. It's talking about global warming, icebergs melting in Antarctica, all kinds of crazy stuff.
There's a lot of theories out there.
So you're not buying global warming?
I'm not going to say a word.
It's a podcast. You have to say a word or I have no open.
I don't want to give my opinion one way or another. How
okay,
about that?
I believe in global warming. Okay, I'll leave it like that. I just know it's hotter than blazes this weekend, and I looked on the thermometer down there in Tilden, Texas. It was 92 today.
With 70% humidity.
And I can speak specifically for South Texas. Whether you buy into global warming or not, South Texas, hotter than a mug. Right now in July, it ain't even got to August.
I think they call it climate change now. That's the buzzword.
The climate change?
Yeah.
Hey, man. Well, if it's four seasons, it's just changing from season to season. This is changing from hot to real hot.
Yeah.
Anyway.
We're experiencing our own heat wave here in Marina Del Rey, actually.
Hey, can I ask you a question on the podcast?
I suppose you can.
You know that I got pretty damn good vision, right?
I wouldn't go that far.
Okay. I can't see like a hawk, but I can see pretty good.
Right.
I only have to use reading glasses.
Right.
Okay. I don't hear very well.
Correct.
But when I'm driving that Range Rover and we're driving to Nevada or back to Los Angeles, I can see the speedometer.
So can I.
So when I'm reading 90 miles an hour and I got the cruise control set, and all of a sudden you chime in, 90 miles an hour? Really? And then a few minutes later, 93 miles an hour? And then a little bit later, Steve, 100 miles an hour? Really? Really? I know how fast we're going. At any time that we're on a trip and I'm behind the wheel, whether we're in town and I'm driving 25 because the speed limit says 25, or if we're out there on the highways and the speed limit is 65 to 75 and I'm running radar to run a little bit faster, I know how fast I'm going. So I wanted to address this on the podcast because you're killing me. It's a 450-mile drive there. It's 450 miles back. And all of a sudden, I just got this little parrot on my shoulder. 93, 100, 85, 87. I know how fast I'm driving, Kristen. I was part of the National Honor Society in high school. And then I got kicked out. And then I went to college and I had a scholarship, but I never made the dean's list. I was a C-plus student. 5 years of college. I didn't get a college degree, but I'm smart enough to know how fast I'm driving by looking at that speedometer.
Yes, so why
do you feel the need to constantly nag and remind me how fast I'm driving?
Because it's very dangerous.
Now, all the trips that we've taken together, all
those times.
It doesn't
matter. You said before we left, we're going to take our time. I said, great. As soon as we get in the car, I'm just going to put the radar in just in case. The next thing I know, we're going 101.
Well, I thought.
And we're in no rush. I said, can we just stop through Mammoth Lakes? I want to show you how beautiful it is. Oh, maybe on the way back. Zoop, right past it.
I told you on the way back because you're trying to rub it in. It's like salt on a wound. He goes, well, we're going to stop by Mammoth Lakes or not. And I said,
sure. I saw the look on your face.
I said, no, but what did I say? I said, sure, if you want to go, we'll go.
With this pregnant pause before you even said anything.
But I was willing to live up to my side of the bargain because on the way down as we blazed through there and undetected because I was running radar, I said, if you want to stop on the way back, I will. So we had that option, and you decided, no, we got a good head of steam. Let's
yeah,
Steve
you gave
keep
me
doing
the sideways thing. Flounder is what you did.
The old sideways flounder is a look. It's almost a stink eye. It was a polite stink eye. But anyway, I know how fast I'm going. We didn't get a ticket. Everything was good. There's a lot of idiots still out on the road texting
and
whatnot.
Every other car was texting.
And then when you get out there and you're on the highways, if you're in the left lane, you're driving slow, you're in the wrong lane. Get out of the way.
People
that's passing
don't get
lane.
That. I don't understand.
It's
that.
Just the basics, people. We was behind some dude who was driving a pretty fancy car, and he kept turning, making lane changes. And I wanted to pull up next to that son of a buck. When we ever pulled through a town at a stop sign and just let him know that neither your left rear turn signal or your right rear turn signal is working because I've been behind you for 75 miles and you've been changing lanes and the thing doesn't work.
Well, why don't we get signs? We can just hang out the window.
That's what I want to do. I want to get one of those things that, you know, like the LED things, just the message flashes across.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah, like so on the front of the windshield, it will be reversed.
Well, actually, in the 80s, we used to have these things. They're like a paddle, and it was some sort of toy that would have messages on it, and you could just rotate to the message you want, like roll your window down, eat crap and die, whatever it was back in the 80s. And you could just flash that little sign out the window. They stopped making those, but that would be a good one too.
Well, the one thing that I kept doing, not that I kept doing, but when you pass by somebody and they're driving in a left-hand lane and you just...
Oh, you let them know.
Well, it's just that sideways glance as you pass by, like, friggin' really?
No, you don't even do that. You just cut them off.
I wouldn't say I cut them off, but I give them that look to the side, just like, come on, work with me here. Just do something. Just get
but
the
they don't
F
get it.
Out of the friggin' way.
If they knew it, they wouldn't be in that lane. So.
No, they know. They know. but they got this, I call it that dumb look.
How about the guy that wouldn't get out of the left lane and wanted to share it with you, the big Toyota truck?
What happened?
He slowly changed to get out of your way, but was doing it to annoy you.
Yeah, there was a couple of those.
Yeah.
Anyway, what else? Oh, man, here's a highlight of our trip.
Oh, boy.
My brother-in-law, Mitch, gave me a neon sign. It's a neon sign from the Nevada Bighorn Sheep Society, whatever it's called. It was made in 1987. So that's not classically an antique, but it's over 30 years old. And I went down to the neon shop where the guy that made it works and shot the breeze with him. So he made that sign 30 years ago, Kristen. It's a beautiful sign. Some of the neon's kind of faded out of the tubes, but it's 30 years old, and it's sitting over there by it's sitting where my desk will be whenever I get the damn thing made, and it will be there from now on. But that is a badass sign. I don't know what it would have costed retail, but the fact is it was done at a raffle for the Nevada Bighorn Sheep Association.
I'm looking it up right now because
my
brother texted me.
30 years ago. So I got that piece of neon, and I've been trying to get that thing back here to 316 Gimmick Street for about a damn year, and Mitch took it back to the guy that made it. It had an electrode or something out, so I am now the proud owner of yet another neon sign, which I do not really have room for, but somehow I will cram into my office with all the rest of the neon stuff. Our electricity bill, due to neon signs, clocks, and BS, is going to be through the roof.
It's called the Nevada Bighorns Unlimited.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah. They made this sign and they raffle them off each year. And so that was one from 1987. So.
And he's got a new name for you, by the way.
Oh, man. So me and my brother-in-law, picture this. We're riding around in a Toyota Tacoma TRD four-wheel drive with a lift all over Nevada. We went down to Pyramid Lake. We went down to Palomino Valley. Went up through Sparks. Went up through Reno. Taking me by the shops. Meeting his friends. Met the guy from Deadeye. All of the guys from Deadeye Outfitters. Along with a couple of other people. And what was the point of my story?
Because you were eating Skippy peanut butter the whole time.
Well, see, man, I've been on my keto diet for a couple of months. Well, a couple of weeks, whatever it's been. Got it dialed in. So part of my eating regimen is with each meal, I'll get a couple of almonds with my protein, eating not any carbs really. But a lot of times I'll just take peanut butter with me because it's just easier to eat. Tablespoon and a half of peanut butter with each meal. So, since I'm riding around, and I missed a couple of meals, I'm riding shotgun in a TRD, four-wheel drive with a lift kit, with a tablespoon and a jar of Skippy peanut butter, eating to my heart's content. And so now, my illustrious brother-in-law, who's probably the most rugged mountain man in the whole state of Nevada, Trapper of the Year, Guide of the Year, all kinds of accolades to his credit for a shoot, he's a real deal, has affectionately named me Skippy. Steve Skippy Austin is my new moniker. To him, he didn't call me Steve. He just calls me Skippy. And now that he knows me so well, he can just take off the PY and just call me Skip.
Yep.
I couldn't believe that at 52 years of age, I have inherited a brand new nickname from my brother-in-law.
Well, because he was having a whiskey, and you were having a tablespoon and a half of peanut butter.
Boy, I tell you what, if you want to test your willpower and you're on any kind of eating regimen, much less a keto diet, and you love whiskey as much as I do, and your brother-in-law's in the kitchen making one drink after another, and I'm sitting there with a tablespoon of Skippy peanut butter, that will test your strength and your willpower.
I'll
and I figure I'm laying down the sacrifice. I'm paying the price to get down to the weight that I want to be at by the time Broken Skull Challenge comes around. And with as hot as it's shaping up to be, I'm going to need to be a few pounds lighter because it's hotter than blazes. I went out to the Broken Skull Challenge compound just yesterday. It was 102. Now, it's going to be hotter when August comes because we start filming here in about 2-3 weeks in the back end of July. And it was 102 degrees. I was out there jockeying my Kawasaki Mule Pro FX and my Pro FX tees around. We're going to wrap one of them for the show. And it was already 102. We're in triple digits, Chris. And last time.
I don't know how athletes can perform in that heat.
Hey, man, it's the toughest show on television. You know, no guts, no glory. I'm recruiting the toughest badasses in the United States of America. And I'll tell you what, there was a young lady come out of Alaska last year.
I
she
remember
got on
that.
The Nutcracker. And, man, she was really game. She was a hell of an athlete. But just that heat zapped her on Nutcracker, and she just tipped over and passed out. So, hey, if you listen to the show, if you're coming out to Broken Skull Challenge, you might want to get some outdoor training in. Hell, that's what I've been doing right now. I'm working out in my backyard, but I'm working out in the heat of the day, so I acclimate already, so I'm ready for the heat.
Oh, is that why you've been working out in the middle of the day?
Yep, there's a method to the madness, honey.
And you were taking those long hikes at my brother's in the heat.
Yep, because I'm getting ready for the heat at the Broken Skull Challenge. We're going to turn the heat up on these athletes.
I guess you will.
Well, before I let you go and continue this open, is there anything else? You want to talk about your social media, Twitter, Instagram?
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate you joining in on the conversation, Kristen. I'll catch you down the road.
See you later, Skippy.
Now, see, you're starting something that don't need to be started. Now, all of a sudden, I'm going to come out with the Skippy 316 says, I just ate your peanut butter shirt.
You're on to something.
All right. Thanks, Kristen.
Goodbye.
All right. Before we get to my conversation with Marty Scurll, let me smarten you up about your shaving needs. Y'all know how much I like saving money. And you know one way I save? Dollar Shave Club. Joining dollarshaveclub.com/Steve gives you a chance to enjoy a luxury shave at an economy price. You get a clean, close, smooth shave without spending a truckload of cash. Buying a razor It's a lot like buying a new car. To get luxury quality, you have to pay a high price. And the reality is that you're really just paying for fancy marketing and features that you don't need. That's why you need to sign up for DollarShaveClub.com/Steve. Dollar Shave Club razors are great quality. They've got the shave tech you actually need and none of the overpriced gimmicks. Dollar Shave Club is a smarter choice. And if you really want to smarten up, then get Dollar Shave Club's executive razor and use it with their Dr. Carver's shave butter. The blade just glides right over your skin, giving you a close, smooth shave. Dr. Carver's shave butter also helps prevent ingrown hairs and razor bumps. So join today at DollarShaveClub.com/Steve and get a smooth shave with a great razor for a fraction of the price. Your skin will thank you for it, and your wallet will too. And right now at DollarShaveClub.com/Steve, new members get their first month of the Executive Razor with a tube of Dr. Carver Shave Butter for only $5 with free shipping. After that, the razors are just a few bucks a month. There are no long-term commitments, no hidden fees, and you can cancel whenever you want. Sign up now at DollarShaveClub.com/Steve. That's DollarShaveClub.com/Steve. I know everybody's got a to-do list. Drop off the dry cleaning, pick up some milk. Here's one for you. Let's add, save hundreds of dollars on car insurance. And the good thing is you don't have to drop off or pick up anything. All you have to do is go to GEICO.com, and in 15 minutes you could be saving 15% or more on car insurance. Extra money in your pocket? It just may be the most rewarding to-do you do today.
Hey, it's Shaq, and when the NBA offseason explodes like it just did, you know we're all over it on The Big Podcast with Shaq. All summer, we're bringing you the biggest guests from the NBA, the biggest stars in Hollywood, and tons of great laughs. We're way bigger than a sports podcast, so check us out this week, The Big Podcast with Shaq, with new episodes every Monday at PodcastOne.com.
The Steve Austin Show.
The Steve Austin Show.
All right, I'm sitting here rolling sound. Martin. Marty Skrull just rolled in. Martin, how are you?
Kayfabe, Marty.
Oh, easy. You're going to get hard about it.
Steve Austin, I appreciate you pronouncing my last name correctly because I know a lot of people do struggle.
What do they pronounce it as?
Normally, it's Marty Skrull. I think Jim Ross actually said Marty Schrull the other night, which was a new one for me. Marty Skrull, Marty, all sorts. Yeah, it's... Skrull. It rhymes with, you know, girl, curl. Yeah, Marty Skrull.
I might just refer to you as the villain.
You could, yeah, that would do.
And it's good to meet you because last time you came through Los Angeles, we hooked up on Twitter and we tried to swing by.
Yeah.
What are you doing back in L.A.? Because New Japan Pro Wrestling just came to town.
It's super. It's been real exciting. So I only debuted for New Japan maybe actually 2 months ago. I got brought over to New Japan for the Best of Super Juniors tour, which is like a cruiserweight tournament. And it always kind of been a dream of mine to do such a thing. When I was younger, I used to watch the Eddie Guerreros and the Jushin Thunder Liger, and they were the guys I looked up to. I mean, guys like yourself and The Rock and Bret Hart, obviously looked up to them as well. But being a smaller guy, I knew I'm probably going to be one of those junior weights myself. So it was always a dream to go to Japan. So I got to make a splash in Japan last month or month before, and then they invited me back to Los Angeles, to do these Long Beach shows. So it's been so awesome because I'm a big believer in we can make an alternative product, we can do something different, and we can get fans invested. They just need to see it. And New Japan's so hot, and the, you know, the talent there is so awesome, it just needs to be seen by people. So, yeah, it's been, you know, I did the show last night, did the show the night before. The fans just so passionate. I think it's going to be the first of many shows here in the U.S. for New Japan.
Hey, man, when you first went over to Japan, you said that was pretty recently.
Yeah.
And you got invited back because I guess they like what they saw, or they wouldn't have invited you back to Los Angeles. So how was working over in Japan? Was that the first trip over?
Yes.
How was it?
I loved it. I loved every minute of it, honestly. I couldn't. The thing is with New Japan is always such a well-oiled machine, and it's like freedom, man. That particular tour I did, the Best of Super Juniors tour, we wrestled every day pretty much. So I think I was there maybe nearly 3 weeks. Probably had 3 or 4 days off, but even those days off, it was travel days. But it was just, the routine's amazing. You stay in a hotel, they say, okay, cool time for the buses. Maybe if it's a long trip, okay, it's 10 o'clock. Okay, you make sure your ass is on that bus by 9:45. Yep. You get your bags. You have the young wrestlers will put the bags on the bus for you. You get on the bus. You got a nice big seat. You got your plug socket so you can plug your thing in. I download a podcast or a video or whatever it might be. Got the Wi-Fi. Sit back, put my chair back. The views in Japan, just so amazing. I remember my first trip on the bus. We were driving through the mountains. I was like, oh, mark it out. Like, this is amazing. Little did I know that that's just everywhere in Japan. That was every day. So I could just zone out and look at these mountains. Anyway, maybe if it's a long trip, 2 hours in the bus ride, we stop for food with all the boys. Get to the venue. We turn up at maybe 4:30. Normally, with you know, all the wrestlers put some gym equipment, some gym gear on. We stretch. So, you know, they bring weights in. We lift some weights. Get dressed maybe 5:30, 5:36. Show will start at 6:30. We all wrestle, boom, 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 boom. As the last match is going on, everyone puts their stuff on the bus. Everyone puts the main events, you know, there's different buses, but they put their bags on the bus. Sit on the bus waiting. As soon as the main event finishes, they get out the ring, they get on the bus, boom, we hit the road. Boom, you know, we're in our next hotel and we're out for dinner by 9 o'clock. It's just, it's brilliant. They do that every day. So just wrestling, working, camaraderie with the boys. I loved it.
Well, tell me about the, you said about the young guys putting the bags underneath the bus. Tell me how the young boy system works over there, because a lot of people listening might not understand what you're talking about. I do.
I mean, obviously, I didn't come in that way. I remember years ago thinking, okay, maybe I'd go to Japan and, you know, maybe join a dojo and try and get in that way. And actually, I like the way, I think how I did mine was, it really worked for me, because I liked coming in as a, almost like a polished performer, you know what I mean? I've been wrestling for so long. So when I got there, I managed to come to Japan and make a pretty decent impact because my act was more well-polished. Obviously, there's still so much room to grow, but when I came out, I don't think anyone in Japan had seen anything like me, or the way I talk, the way I look, the way I wrestle. Obviously, coming to the ring with the mask and the hat and the umbrella, what the hell? And the entrance and the whoops and everything else, and the crowd really lapped it up. Which is awesome. Sorry, I'm going away. I'm trying to put myself over. I'm supposed to be talking about the young boys.
Put yourself over, kid. It's
well,
my podcast.
You know, this is a podcast. If I'm not here for anything, it's to put myself over. But the young boys, so they'll take on New Japan, I think. I might be wrong. People probably correct me. But I think maybe every year or 2 years, they'll take on 4 young guys to train at a dojo. They have this awesome dojo in Japan, and they train hard. They train insane. We're talking 1,000 squats a day, you know, Hindu push-ups, the lot. Those guys work hard, and they have, you know, a lot of jobs to do. They, you know, they do the wrestlers' laundry and stuff. They get paid for that.
They're learning, but they're paying dues, and it's respect.
And they're, you know, they're lifting bags, and they are there to look after the boys, look after the veterans, and, you know, they have a lot of hard work to do. But people might think, oh God, they're given so much to do, it's hard. But if they get through that young boy system, they have a job for life. A job, you know, no matter, as long as they don't mess up, they have a job for life with you know, with New Japan. And I think all Japanese promotions work the same. So they pay their dues for X amount of years. They'll be a young boy, essentially. So they'll wrestle, they're allowed to have to shave their heads, wrestle in black trunks and black boots, no knee pads or whatnot. They may be allowed one signature move, but it'd be something very basic, maybe like a drop kick or a judo throw, and they'll do that for years. They'll be in the opening matches. Sometimes they might mix, you know, the odd veteran in a tag match, and then maybe after 2-3 years, whenever it's ready, they get sent on what's called an excursion. So they might get sent to America, they might get sent to Mexico or to England, and this is basically to give them time away to maybe learn a different language, be repackaged and, you know, find themselves in a different country. That's it. So like a good one at the moment, I mean, every top guy in Japan, Okada, they all did it. In fact, Okada's he was working in DNA years ago, which people don't even remember, on an excursion. But recently, Hiromaru Takahashi, he went on like a 3-year excursion. He was in England, he was in Mexico, he was in America. And every time I see him, I say, oh, are you okay? Oh, I miss Japan. And I thought, oh, bless him. And he seemed like quite a timid, quiet man. And then his last maybe 6 months, he come up with this crazy time bomb character in Mexico. And he just come back to Japan as just a huge star. They brought him back as this big, big deal. And now he's one of the most popular stars in Japan. So it's a really cool system. Like, I don't feel like any other culture of wrestling does it like they do in New Japan, but the young boy system certainly works. And you know, it's all based on respect, and I think that's very important in this job for sure.
Hey man, when you was growing up as a kid, like, where do you live now?
So now I live in a place called Portsmouth, England, which is like on the south coast, but I originally grew up in Cambridgeshire, yeah, in England.
So, okay, so when did you first start watching the business?
So this is gonna sound like a really cheesy line, but I honestly feel like I was always meant to be a wrestler, despite my, you know, small stature or whatnot, because I kind of found wrestling, like, I was never pushed towards wrestling at all. It kind of came to me. So my parents divorced when I was a baby, and me and my brother were brought up by my mother. Maybe see my father once every few months or so. Anyway, so mum pretty much single-handedly, for the most part, brought me and my brother up. And she used to work in a mental health house,
yeah,
just looking after patients. Anyway, so when I wasn't at school or whatnot, she couldn't afford a babysitter, so she'd take me to the place. And there was nothing to do as a kid in this house other than watch television. And daytime TV in England is not really made for kids, you know? So all we had was videos to watch. And all they had for the videos was horror movies, which obviously I was a five-year-old boy. If my mom wasn't there, I'd maybe try and sneak, you know, Friday the 13th. But they had a bunch of wrestling videos.
Yeah.
And I can't really remember because I was so young, but I think the first tape is certainly one of them. And the first match that I watched, because many years later, got the video, was a video called The Mick McManus World of Wrestling. Obviously, Mick McManus, a legend in British wrestling. And the first ever match I think I saw was Dave Finley and Danny Boy Collins, which is funny because I've met both of them since. And I said, you know, don't take this the wrong way, but you were the first match I saw when I was a child. Nice to meet you. And the reason why I say I feel like I was meant to be a wrestler, because I kind of fell into these videos, and legit, the second I saw it, I knew, I was like, I'm going to be a wrestler. Like instantly, jumping up and down on the sofa. And obviously, I was like a five-year-old kid. I didn't know it was at work. So I was like, I guess I'm going to be a badass fighter when I'm older, you know? And I remember going to school and saying, oh, I'm going to be a wrestler. Five-year-old kid. Like, oh, you might get hurt. And I said, I don't care, because I loved it so much. And that kind of started my obsession. And there was a bunch of weird tapes. It was some British stuff. There was some stuff from Texas, but then obviously I found a Hulk Hogan's video and The Undertaker's video, and that stuff just took me off.
But what about, was World of Sports still playing?
Mm-mm.
So it was already off?
No.
Okay.
So basically, British wrestling was on TV for many years in the 60s, 70s, and the 80s, and it got taken off in, I believe, 1988, which ironically was the year I was born.
Right.
So it got taken off, but it used to be on like prime time TV. Like, we only used to have three channels in the UK, and it was on one of the main, well, probably the main channel, and it was on Sunday afternoon, I want to say. And it, obviously the ratings for it were massive, and it was a shoot. People believed it. People really enjoyed it. They'd watch. It wasn't a case of everyone was wrestling fans. It was just something people would watch, much like they might watch Countdown or I might go over the head of some people with a reference there, or the news or anything else. Oh, the wrestling's on, okay. Much like, oh, the football's on, or soccer. So it was a big part of English culture, and it got taken off, like I said, when I was born. And so by time I was sort of five or six, because it got taken off TV, a lot of the boys back in the day, they pretty much quit, and they kept running house shows and stuff, but the business just went down to the point where when I was a child, wrestling our country was pretty much scrapped, pretty much done for the most part. The only thing that saved it, funny enough, wrestling in Britain was the holiday camps. I don't know if you've heard of these before, but so it's a really hard thing to explain. But so the UK is full of holiday parks, which are essentially caravan sites or next to, you know, beaches in the UK, where people go stay in chalets or caravans, and they provide entertainment for you know, the holiday goers. So they'll have people singing or whatnot, or magic. And for some reason, wrestling was a show that was easily presented at a holiday camp.
Right.
So you used to turn up, put the ring up, do a couple of matches, and it's entertainment. So I remember being a kid, and because we used to go to these holiday camps, because like I said, my family was pretty my mother especially, you know, money was tight. We didn't have a lot. And so we might go to a holiday camp for 4 or 5 days, holiday a year. I remember seeing wrestling on the holiday camps and being like, wow, okay, there is wrestling in the UK. I was like, okay, maybe I'll have to, because originally I just thought, if I want to be a wrestler, I guess I'm just going to have to move to America and call WWE and ask them to be a wrestler. Like, I had no idea, you know? Right. And then I saw this wrestling on the holiday camp. I was like, oh, I guess I'm going to have to like start wrestling on holiday camps before I...
Was there any names that you remember?
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think off the top of my head. I mean, a lot of the guys did cross over from the kind of world of sport era. So guys like Robbie Brookside, who's now a coach at NXT. And I think even Regal, those guys, they all did, like Butlins especially, which is like the premium holiday camp. Trust me, there's some really shoddy holiday camps. But the thing is as well, it's not only that, but again, British culture is so weird that, like, not so much these days, but Britain's always been so big into its tribute acts. So, you know, you could always go see the Who tribute or the Beatles tribute. Somehow, I don't know how, but this managed to cross over into wrestling. So British wrestling essentially died. The holiday camps were happening, and they started, and especially when the Attitude Era kicked off, obviously there was promoters in the UK that saw money back in wrestling, but they didn't want to promote British wrestling. They thought, oh, the American wrestling, that's what people want to see these days, the American wrestling. So they would promote the American wrestling with British wrestlers, but they would have tribute wrestlers. So they would have Justin Starr tonight as Kane and bloody blah as, you know, Steve Boston or whatever it was. And it was bizarre for me as a child, because I remember going to see these shows and you would have quite a bit of a crossover with real actual talent. So Jake the Snake would be on, the real Jake the Snake would be on the shows. Right. The real Marty Jannetty would be on the shows. But then you'd have a fake Legion of Doom and a fake Undertaker. So it was so bizarre. And that was a thing for years that I used to go watch. But there was also like some real awesome wrestlers on it. Guys like, I don't know if you heard, like Chad Collier, who was trained by Dean Malenko, and Johnny Storm, who, so I watched him as like a 12-year-old kid, and he turned out to be one of my good friends and mentors years later. But there was a, you know, it was British wrestling kind of came back then off the back of the, like the Attitude Era and everything else, because there was money in wrestling and become popular in the UK again, because wrestling didn't really get more popular in the UK. I think the peak actually wasn't the Attitude Era, it was more 2000, because they had a deal with Channel 4. So 98 started getting big, 99 was huge, 2000 was just insane in the UK.
So then where do you go if you're trying to get in the wrestling business in England?
So
I mean, it's a lot of I enjoy about a lot of guys come from England is just that highly technical stuff, which you are very proficient at.
Right. So my story is a bit strange. I obviously I was a massive WWE fan, and me and my friends essentially started wrestling in my living room, taking videos and giving ourselves characters and whatnot. So not really backyard wrestling, more like, oh, I'm going to be Bret Hart, whatever, and messing around. Anyway, so we used to like to, you know, pretend to wrestle with each other. Anyway, went to a WWE show at the NEC in Birmingham, and there was a massive queue waiting up to get in the show. And me and my friends thought, we just thought we would start wrestling on the grass. We're only about 13, 14, just kids mucking around. So we start wrestling on the grass and taking bumps on the grass and everything. Next thing I know, there's about 200 people in the queue marking out for us, cheering us and, you know, encouraging us. So it's almost like my first match untrained and doing everything, going crazy, and all the fans going, yeah, and I was like, oh, this is awesome, I like this, I'm a wrestler now. And it's like, hopefully Vince McMahon will walk past and be like, oh, guys, come in, you got a job. That didn't happen, but almost something similar. Some guy came past and said, oh, you guys, you probably you shouldn't really be wrestling on the grass, because I actually know of a wrestling school. It's in Essex, which at the time was about an hour and a half away from where I lived. And in the US, that's not a long trip. In the UK, that's a... Yeah. So I go back home, beg my mother to take me to this wrestling school based in Essex. And sure enough, she knew how much I loved wrestling. And also my mum always said this. She always thought that wrestling was a phase that I'd grow out of. Bearing in mind, I'd already loved it from like the 6 years old or 5 years old to 14. But she assumed, okay. And plus at the time, I had such bad attention span that I was in school just getting in trouble left, right, and center. You know, I couldn't answer him back. And to be fair, like, having watched the Attitude Era, my favorite wrestlers were telling people to suck it. They were hitting people with cars. They were setting people on fire. What chance did I have as a kid in school? Come on. Like these, like I said, my father wasn't around too much. So these wrestlers were my, you know, role models. They were my male influences. And they were doing, you know, like yourself, not saying you're a bad influence, Steve. But so I'd go to school and I'd do the thing and I'd do the crotch chop. And, you know, that didn't bode too well for me in school. I was a smart kid and I went on to get a degree and everything else at university. But I used to mess around a lot. So my mum saw this wrestling school as a good place for me to put my attention to, get my all my excitement out of my system. Anyway, the school I went to was run by some very old school British wrestlers. And so it was pretty much shoot amateur. So my first 2 years was shoot and amateur. And we used to have a lot of old school British guys come in into the school, guys like Steve Gray would come in and Wayne Bridges. And a lot of the old school from the back in the day, Bobby Barnes, all these guys who I started watching because, you know, they come into the school. And I just fell in love with that old British style. Obviously, I grew up on the American style. And then I just started watching this British stuff and got so... I just thought it was so artistic and so unique. And I thought, cool. And it made me proud to be like, oh, we are. Because I always looked at America as this big kind of wonderful place that I saw on TV. I'd see movies in America and, you know, all my favorite singers and music artists were from America, and I'd watched the Power Rangers that was in America, and it was this kind of desired place that seemed so far away. And then watching this British wrestling, I was like, wow, there was actually all this in the UK. I couldn't believe it. So I started to lean towards guys like your Finleys and your Mark Roccos, and especially the lighter weights as well, like your Steve Grays and Mel Sanders. And that's the style I fell in love with, and that's the style I trained in, to the point where I remember a year or two into my wrestling career, and someone called a sleep leap hip toss, international high spot. And I had no clue what they were talking about. Obviously, everyone here knows, you know, if you're a wrestler, you know that spot, but we didn't even used to hit the ropes. We just wrestled with each other.
Right.
It was a work, but it was a shoot.
Right.
And I loved that, and I fell in love with it instantly, and I thought, maybe I'll just do this now.
How did you gravitate towards the training? Because when I first started in my wrestling school in 1989, I mean, man, I was really slow to pick things up with a little bit of the chain wrestling. We didn't have near the technical stuff that you guys come up with. So was it natural for you? Were you a quick learner?
I think the shoot and amateur stuff, to a degree, but we never learned any of the other stuff, so... I didn't learn really how to work until I got into holiday camps and I was wrestling every day, sometimes 2 or 3 times a day. I trained for a good year and a half before my first match, but I think that might be because I was a 14-year-old boy, 15-year-old boy. From what I remember, like, I want to say I took to it quickly, but in hindsight, probably not. I'm sure if I watched back my matches from back then, I you know, it'd probably be terrible. And I feel like even I can't even watch my matches from as far back as a year or two ago, because, you know, obviously you always improve. And I look back now and go, oh, what was I doing? And it takes a long time to find yourself in this business. I mean, you know, you tell the story of the time you were the ringmaster when you found, you know, Stone Cold Steve Austin, you had that rocket on you, and boom, you went away. But it took me a long time to find myself, for sure.
How long did it take you to come up with the villain? Because like you said, my thing was everything. I got, dang, man, it was almost an overnight success. No, man, I was an overnight success. It took 8 years to happen, and then we were off to the races. But I was ready, because I had damn near 8 years of seasoning, working, paid my dues, knew the business, backwards, forwards, and, well, there's always more to learn, like you said. But worked heel, baby, so things worked out for me. But as the evolutionary process worked for Marty Scurll, how did you develop the villain?
So my trainers always said to me, okay, I don't know how right they were with this, but they always said, listen, as long as you can actually wrestle, then you always have a job. Which I thought, okay. So I was always so concentrating on the wrestling aspect. Anyway, in 2013, no, maybe 14, so not that long ago, I got injured. I separated my AC joint in my shoulder. You see my kind of sticks out a bit there.
Yeah.
And so I was going to be out for a good 3 months. And at the time, I pretty much was only wrestling for an income as well. So, and I'd been wrestling for a long time, but I, you know, I had a little spell with TNA, and but I hadn't, and then, you know, the UK scene was still growing, but it wasn't like I was getting rich or anything else. And I thought, I need to come up with something to, for people to invest in. And that's what I need. I said, I'm going out there now and I'm trying to have these great matches, and none of it means anything. And I actually read Legion of Doom's autobiography, The Road Warriors, and they were talking about when they debuted, they were like, we wanted to stand out. So they were already 300-pound muscled up guys, but they shaved mohawks, they put face paint on, they put those awesome shoulder pads. So they obviously got it from the get-go. It took me a little longer. And I looked at myself and I thought, wow, got short back and sides. I didn't have any facial hair. I wear a pair of trunks and I do a nice wrist lock and not much else. And I thought, what am I doing? I need to come up with something here. I need to give the people reason to invest in, because especially the wrestling I do was fine. And like my trainer said, I could wrestle, so I'd have a job, but I needed more substance. I needed more, some more layers. And I remember amazing quote, which always just stuck with me for many, many years. And I quote it all the time now, is Matt Groening. I think I'm saying that right. He wrote The Simpsons. And he said that every great character could be can be recognized from its silhouette. And I thought, yeah, that's interesting. Okay, so Homer, I can tell Marge, yep, Bart, yep, Lisa, etc. And I thought, right, so I need to find something. And it wasn't like I come up with that villain character overnight. It's an over-developing thing. But it was when I was injured, quite a few promoters were nice and said, okay, we know you're injured, but you know, maybe you can come down, you can manage someone or come to the ring with them or be a mouthpiece. And I thought, okay, cool. And I thought, what can I wear to the ring? Like, I can't just wear street clothes. And I thought, wouldn't it be funny if I just wore a big fur coat like an idiot, you know? Because people don't wear... In Los Angeles, they might wear fur coats around here, but in England, you don't. So I came to the ring with a fur coat and a pair of silly glasses, and I'd started growing my hair out already. But this is before the top knot, what they call it now, was really popular, but I just tied my hair up obnoxiously, just anything to stand out, and that was that. And people were booing the hell out of me. I come to the ring and say, yeah, this is... an Armani 2,000-pound coat, and all the crowd, no, it's from Primark, which is like a cheap shop. Primark, it's not from Primark. It just, gaga, cheap heat, whatever. But either way, it was getting a reaction. Anyway, and later on, I came back to the wrestling again. My whole character, pretty much every aspect of it, is to pop myself. And if it pops me, if I think it's funny, 9 times out of 10, the fans go with it. So one day, I was at a show. There was an umbrella by the curtain. I'd take the umbrella to the ring. Walked to the ring with the umbrella and was pointing it at people and everything else. And it was just so super silly. Everyone thought it was kind of funny. And that was that. And then a few days later, my friend goes, hey, Marty, that umbrella you brought to the ring. He goes, that was really cool. You should stick with that. And I was like, dude, I was just joking. A week later, I'm flying to a show somewhere. And go, I'm not taking my umbrella. I don't want to carry this umbrella around. I land wherever it was. I get this tweet. Hey, can't wait to see Marty Skeleton tonight. His umbrella. So I thought, okay, I better go to a shop and find myself an umbrella. And that thing stuck with me. And I think it's those things that stick with people, that resonate with people. So I think of Steve Austin, you know, I think of the fingers, and I think of the stunner, and I think of the trucks and everything else, or I think of the rock, I think of the eyebrow, or whatever it might be. And so now it's one of those things, even if they don't remember anything from my match specifically, they might be like, oh, look at the idiot with the city coat and the umbrella. And again, it's just been one of those things that's developed. I was always interested in villains and especially being British. That's kind of another reason why I like the umbrella, because like my friend Zack Sabre, he comes to the ring and he's got the Union Jack all over him. He's representing the UK, proud. But I didn't want to be quite as obvious as that. But I thought the umbrella is like a little nod to the UK because of our miserable weather. And but like I said, I added the master hat and everything else. And it's just a big, long development, and it's changing all the time. And kind of, we had a conversation earlier where I said wrestling just changes so much, and you could be hot one minute and hot, you know, not hot the next. I'm trying to think like months and months in advance, and I'm trying to think what the next step is to stay hot, because I almost feel like the wrestling is super important, but that whole other aspect of it is a big part. I've had a lot of wrestling fans come to me and say they're massive fans of mine and never seen an actual match, just seen my promos or videos that I've done, or they might have seen a music video when I've a few clips of me wrestling, but they can get into that character. So for me, that's always been super important. And the villain aspect, I was always a big fan of Alex from Clockwork Orange, and obviously Heath Ledger with the Joker. I was like, well, I think it could be onto something here. I think, villain, that's kind of, yeah, that can work. And marketable as well. The Umbrella, that was super duper marketable for me. Obviously, you know a thing or two about merchandise and t-shirt sales, Steve. But when I started putting these umbrellas and stuff, I was selling so many t-shirts. And then that mask, one day I just thought, oh, this would be a good entrance. One entrance. So I'm going to wear a mask and a hat. Because I'd seen a mask on an album cover. And I thought, oh, I'm going to do this big entrance. Because every now and then I'd do something cool for an entrance. Anyway, I did this. It was going to be a one-time thing. But then social media, they tell you, all this fan art was of me in this mask. And yeah, and I was like, this mask is over. Started putting on t-shirts. Now I go to shows, everyone's wearing the mask, everyone's got the umbrellas. So I'm like, okay, we're going to run with this. You know, it's just, I feel like the more and more years I'm wrestling, I'm just collecting more and more props. And it's just a massive rib on myself because I've got to carry it around everywhere.
Dude, towards the end of my career, I was so beat up. I told people I used to wrestle on the side and drink for a living.
Right.
So, yeah, all the character traits kind of, you know, helped me out.
Absolutely. So, well, you know, I think with you as well, I think you're an absolute fine example because watch your work back in the day and it was a lot more technical and a lot more ring-based and everything else, but people don't remember you for that. I don't think they remember you. I mean, I do, or wrestling fans do.
Right.
But most people, when they think of Steve Austin, they think of you driving a truck and spraying beer over everyone and raising hell and whatever it is.
Yeah,
you know
yeah.
what I mean? So that's, I think that's the wrestling is important, but that's just as important, if not more so.
So if you're going out there, and I know you're working with Ring of Honor right now.
Yeah.
With New Japan Pro Wrestling. Mm-hmm. You still do some other gigs.
So yeah, I still live in England. My contract is with Ring of Honor, but I'm still allowed to do independent outside of America. So I still work in England every now and then, Europe, maybe Australia or Mexico, and these other cool places. Well, in a few months, I'm going to Costa Rica and stuff. So it's good in that sense. I pretty much get to be my own boss and do what I do.
Before we take a break, a pause for the cause for the sponsors. Keep the show on the air twice a week for free. How can people find you on social media? Or I know everybody knows how to find you for bookings, but if they don't, how can people find Marty Scurll, the villain?
I'm on Twitter. It's at Marty Scurll. That's S-C-U-R-L-L. Same with the Instagram. And in terms of contact, my friend James Musselwhite is running a Facebook page for me. I'm not too into the Facebook yet, but I was trying to build that up, and that's the villain Marty Scurll. So you can probably contact me on there as well.
Hey, I'm coming right back. We're going to talk about working heel, baby, and all kinds of BS. Anyway, Marty Scurll coming right back to 317 Gimmick Street. So I got to give a shout out to my former roommate, close personal friend, Diamond Dallas Page, because he's still so fired up about his WWE Hall of Fame induction that he's taking the celebration on the road. He's doing the DDP UK tour, and you can take part in his inspirational Q&A when it comes to Glasgow, Manchester, Birmingham, and London. DDP will be telling stories, signing autographs, taking selfies, and he's going to motivate the heck out of you to live the healthiest life you can. Dallas is kicking off his Hall of Fame UK tour on September 2nd and 3rd at the Fanatic Expo in Harrogate. And one of his infamous DDP workshops will be included too. Get in on Dallas's Inspiration Meets Perspiration workshop and let him help you achieve your fitness goals and get on the path to healthier living. Reserve your spot now at ddpuktour.com. And if Dallas ain't going to be in a city near you, then download the DDP Yoga Now app and join one of the live workouts from the DDP Yoga Performance Center in Smyrna, Georgia. It's the next best thing to working out in person with Dallas. And the app has everything. It's got over 150 workouts. It's got nutrition tips. It's got recipes. It's got cooking shows and the tools to track your progress. And it lets you do DDP yoga wherever and whenever you want, right from your smartphone or tablet, whenever you want. And right now, you can get the app and the DVDs for 20% off. Just go to ddpyoga.com/Austin. So take advantage of this great sale. 20% off the app, the DVDs, and all clothing at ddpyoga.com/Austin. Folks, it's time to own your life. Start today. ddpyoga.com/Austin.
If you're looking to buy a new or used vehicle, then you need to download the TrueCar app or check out TrueCar.com. TrueCar gives you the price and information you need to feel confident about your vehicle purchase. When you register with TrueCar, you'll see what other people in your local area paid for the car you want. And from there, you can connect with a local TrueCar certified dealer and enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Listen, TrueCar shows you real pricing on actual inventory, so you see competitive pricing offered to you by TrueCar certified dealers for vehicles that are actually on their lots. And you'll also see all the dealer incentives before you get to the lot so you can feel confident about the price when you show up. TrueCar makes car buying easy, no matter if you're looking for a brand new or used vehicle. And the stats don't lie. Over 3 million. 3 million cars have been sold to TrueCar users by the TrueCar Certified Dealer Network. There are over 13,000 dealers in that network with some 700,000 pre-owned vehicles available. So do yourself a favor and go to TrueCar for your next car buying experience. TrueCar doesn't just make the process easier. It'll also save you some money. TrueCar users save an average of over $3,000 off MSRP. So when you're ready to buy a new or used car, visit TrueCar to enjoy a better car buying experience. Some features not available in all states. Right here back at 317 Gim Street, talking with Marty Skrull, the villain. Hey, man, with your style, highly technical, and you brought up your friend, Zack Sabre. He had a match a while back in the New Japan Pro Wrestling card at Los Angeles, well, Long Beach to be specific, with Juice Robinson. It was one of my favorite matches of the night. A lot of technical stuff done by Zack Sabre Jr., and Juice just sold the hell out of it, good fire. It was a really good match. So when you go out there with the guy, with respect to the highly technical stuff that you can do, and I saw a couple of matches with you and Zach on YouTube, really, really good stuff. You guys have great chemistry, same background. When you hit the ring, man, I mean, or how in Japan or in Ring of Honor, are you taken as the heel or babyface, or does it matter? You're just the villain. Take you as they want to.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head here. The thing is, I think with the heel and face divide now, why it's different to back in the day is the way that I would define a heel back in the day is someone that, or a wrestler that the fans would pay to see get beaten up. And in 2017, I don't think it's impossible, but it's not like that anymore in the sense that the fans are essentially told these days that it's a work at World Wrestling Entertainment. They're told it's fake. So they're not paying really anymore, I don't think, to see a heel get beaten up in a fake fight. You know what I mean? That being said, I do think there's obviously you have to have those protagonists and antagonists in wrestling. And that's where you can build a story. So for me, I feel like I'm more of an antagonist. I don't think people are paying to see me get beaten up. I think they're paying to see me be entertained. And I think the problem is as well, if you try and, because the fans, they can be so smart these days. If you can be such an antagonist, it gets to the point where the fans, they know the business, they know it's heels and faces, and they think, he's so good at being an antagonist, we like him.
Right.
Again, you're a prime example back in the day. So I just say, it's funny when people say, sometimes I'll get some fans will be like, oh man, you're such a good heel. And I think that's funny. I'm not a heel because there's a bunch of people cheering for me. Or the other way, sometimes some of the boys will say, oh, you're not a real heel. You're a terrible heel. You sell too many t-shirts. You're not a heel. I go, whoa. When did I even say I was a heel? I'm a villain. That's up to you how you take it. Right. I still do Dick Dastardly acts, whether they cheer or boo. That's down to them. And I feel like that's the way it is. Whether you like it or not, you have to go with it. It's much like UFC. So if I asked you now, Conor McGregor, is he heel or face?
Well, to me, he's babyface.
Because you like him.
Yeah.
Some people can't stand him.
Seriously. Yeah, I like the fact that he talks trash.
Right.
And that he can back it up. But, and he entertains the hell out of me.
He's entertaining.
And I'm invested in his fights.
But he essentially, he acts like an antagonist for sure, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Same with, don't think for a second I'm comparing myself to Brock Lesnar, but I don't think Brock Lesnar's a heel or a face. He's just Brock Lesnar. He's just a badass. Right? And I feel like that now, like the group I'm in, especially the Bullet Club, essentially are supposed to be heels, But it's the most overact, you know, outside the WWE.
Dude, I was there in New Japan Pro Wrestling in Long Beach and watching the stuff on TV. Man, there's so many Bone Club t-shirts out there. And they got Villain Club t-shirts out there. And that was a sea of black shirts with white print on them. Most of them said Bullet Club, Villain Club. So, obviously, who started the Bullet Club? Did the Japanese start that? Or did the Americans that were working over there start that? And it became a faction, and then guys leave, but then they refill the roles. Tell me about that.
Because
it has transcended the business.
Yeah, it's nuts, man. I believe it was Fergal Devitt that started it. Finn Balor. He was he turned heel. He'd been in Japan. He'd come through the system in Japan. He was a young boy, I believe, there. And went through the dojo. And he'd been there a long time, and he wanted to do something different, and they let him have a heel turn, or an antagonist turn, as I'm going to call it now. And he was calling himself at the time the Real Shooter, I think it was. And he was teaming up with Carl Anderson, who was the Machine Gun. So they called themselves the Bullet Club. And I think it started off as a rib, I think. Again, I'm convinced all these best gimmicks start as ribs. And that's how it started. And it just took off. It started with those guys, and then they would add, like, later on the Young Bucks came in.
Yep.
And it essentially was the heel group in Japan for the foreigners, essentially. And like the Young Bucks started, and it kind of took a world of its own. And then later on AJ Styles, and then when he, you know, Kenny Omega came in, and it's come to the point now where it's about as much pop culture as anything outside WWE could be. Tekken is in the new, Bullet Club is in the new Tekken game on PlayStation and Xbox. It's like I said, we signed a deal with Hot Topic. So in every single Hot Topic in American Canada, you can buy Villain Club t-shirts, you can buy Bullet Club t-shirts. And it's so great. Like, I didn't realize the extent of how big it is until I joined it. It's just, for some reason, I think always in wrestling, people love that. They love the groups. And I think a big part of it might be that friendship thing. I think people like, because obviously I'm with Kenny Omega now and the Young Bucks, and people love watching our friendship. We have a YouTube show called Being the Elite, and we do weekly episodic stuff. And again, it's all just ribs. It's just us filming stuff. We think it's funny. It's kind of poorly acted, poorly edited. The fans love it.
When you get a chance to entertain yourselves, right. People get a chance to have to watch that stuff. It's enjoyable.
And it's not a script. It's not being told what to do. We're just having a laugh. And people see that friendship, they see that camaraderie, and they love it. And I think that's why people like the Bullet Club. They like the idea of a group and being part of a gang, and that's why they want the t-shirt. Same with the DX back in the day, and same with NWO. It's just, it was a cool thing. And it's funny because, so we all grew up, we were all young teenagers or teenagers during the Attitude Era and whatnot. And so we watched DX and we watched NWO, and we were big fans of it. And now we're adults. We're just acting like that because we think it's funny. And the fans think it's funny as well. They think, oh, it's cool. You know, they like us. They just like Mark and Alpha. You know, they're all favorites. And they want to get in on the act as well. So I think that's why it's super popular. It's so much bigger than I thought.
What's the difference between, nowadays when you go on your tours of New Japan to doing stuff with Ring of Honor or like a PWG show, as we were talking off the microphone? I mean, PWG, kind of like, man, everybody's in, and it's high spot, and everybody goes away happy and gets a chance to push the envelope from an excitement standpoint and play everything up. But let's just say Ring of Honor for argument's sake. Compared to New Japan, crowd versus crowd, psychology versus psychology, is it all one and the same? Are you?
No, I'd say it was different for sure. The crowds in Japan, they're very respectful. And I feel like with the influx of foreign talent over there in the years and the influence of groups like the Bullet Club there, they are a lot more, actually, more into the gaga than people might think.
Really?
Yeah. They actually... I probably do less sort of technical stuff in Japan because they get so excited for me just flapping my wings and stuff because they've never seen anything like it. And they actually like that stuff. But it's so cool there because what's great with Japan is they 9 times out of 10, they react how you envision they're going to react. And that's great. And they'll they'll go with it. If, you know, you're in a hold, or you're, you know, in a submission, and you struggle and you show that you're in a moment of danger and you're reaching for the ropes, and they see it on your face and they believe in it, and they want to get behind it because the kayfabe is really still alive in New Japan. And you grab that rope and boom, the big pop, you know, they go for stuff like that. In America, sometimes they'll go with it, sometimes they won't, and you got to switch stuff up. And the same with, kind of like we were saying before, in Japan, the way they treat heels and faces is kind of almost transcended into America, because there's antagonists and protagonists. There's essentially bad guys who cheat and do stuff they right. shouldn't, and but they're all pretty much cheered the same. It's kind of like a sport,
right?
If that makes sense. But the fans there, the show's build as well, which is a lot different to America. So I feel like in American structures, you give them a really good, you know, maybe an exciting 12-minute opener, good heel, good baby, boom, boom, boom. Not too much, but a little bit of, you know, razzmatazz. Boom. Then maybe the next match, you bring it down a little bit. And then before the break, you give them like a nice tag match, blah, blah, blah. Bring it down before the main. Then the main event hits, boom, boom, all the explosions, all the fireworks. Everyone goes home happy. But whereas in Japan, it builds. The matches are in order of importance. So you wouldn't, you know, sometimes you watch WWE and they might even start with a world title match. That is not happening in New Japan. Right. You're going to start with the young boys. You're going to start, and the importance of the matches. And it's great how the crowd, they're conditioned to be that way. So when this, you know, when the start of the show happens, they're not jumping out their seats going nuts, but they sure as hell will be by the main event, because right. the guys go all out there. So
go ahead.
So no, the styles, I mean, Ring of Honor is obviously a lot more, hence the name, is a lot more ring based than a lot of the other American promotions. That's the thing as well, is it's places, it's Ring of Honor, it's on TV, and they have the, you know, they do have some, you know, pretty great production, but like, still, for the most part, Ring of Honor and definitely PWG, there's not a whole lot of glitz and glamour. There's not a whole lot of gaga. It's pretty much based on what's, you know, happening in between those ropes. And I think that's why, not that it frustrates me, not that it's wrong, but when people say, okay, wrestling should be this way and it should be that way, and oh, these guys are doing too much, these guys are doing all this, you know, it's what they're saying to a degree is correct. But what I think people need to understand is these are supposed to be alternative products, okay? If they try and do the same as like a WWE and try and do the same, but with a, you know, a small percentage of the budget, they're going to come across as WWE Lite. So they need to provide an alternative that might not be doing a million high spots and a million dives, but they still need to be doing something different. So when you're saying it should be like this style, like our style, I don't necessarily agree with that.
How hard is it to climb up the ranks of the New Japan system?
I mean, I've only just started, so I couldn't necessarily answer that. But I think I remember years and years ago, I was having a drink with Rob Van Dam, and I had like a tiny little spell in TNA. It wasn't particularly great, and he kind of just said to me, he knew he could tell, I think he could tell I was passionate about the business. He said, listen, he goes, the cream always rises to the top. And for me, I kind of feel like if you love something enough and you put enough enthusiasm into it and you just don't give it up, you just go for it, you're gonna get somewhere eventually. You're gonna get good at it. If I studied maths for 12 years every day, I'd probably be quite good at maths by now. So in New Japan, like Kenny Omega is a good example, and he brought him in as a junior weight, and because it's almost like the junior weights and then above them is the heavyweights. He was born in a junior weight, but he just absolutely killed that division, and it got to the point where they couldn't deny him. He was just so hot and so, you know, they knew they had to invest in him, so they moved him up to the heavyweight, and now he's breaking the grounds, and he's the first foreign winner of the G1, and they can't deny it. They can't deny the popularity of him. They can't deny his ring work. They can't deny when they turn up to shows and everyone's wearing the club shirts. So, and that's why it was exciting when I went to Japan, how the fans responded to me, how, like the first night I was there, one of the Japanese people come up to me and said, oh, the villain shirts are sold out straight away. It's my first night. I was like, oh, yes, come on, like, brilliant. You know, they can't. I said, even if I stink it in the ring now, they've got to look at the numbers. I always say, I said to my girlfriend on the team, I say, I'm a numbers man. I all the time, someone says, okay, this doesn't make sense, or they shouldn't do that. I say, hey, I'm a numbers man. So what are they bringing to the, you know, I'm a businessman. What are they bringing to the market? And I think that, and so with New Japan, I feel like, if I continue to be me and continue to have good matches and have a character with some substance and some depth and some layers, hopefully, you know, obviously the rise to the top would absolutely be what I'd hope to achieve there. And I want to think outside of the box as well of wrestling. So obviously I want to be on the top of the wrestling world and be champion or, you know, the world, wherever it is, but I'd like to help move the business. I'd like to get us into pop culture. I'd like to connect with the fans in that way. And so, you know, and I feel like with the Bullet Club, especially, and guys like Kenny and the Young Bucks keep mentioning, and even guys like Zack Sabre and Will Ospreay, I feel like we're a part of this movement right now. It's not necessarily the movement like the Attitude Era, but we've got to try, and I feel like we're getting somewhere, you know? So that's what I'd like to do. I'd like to, if I could do anything, almost help move the business. The reason why I came to Ring of Honor, I had quite a few offers in different places, but I thought Ring of Honor was a perfect fit for me because I was like, I could come to Ring of Honor, I could help this company grow, I could hopefully get it on TV in the UK, I can build this company, hopefully get it rather than doing shows in front of 2,000 people, we want to do shows in front of 10,000, maybe 20,000. And I think that's a big thing for me, and especially now with how the independent wrestler, now is the best time ever to be an independent wrestler. And we're changing what it means to be an independent wrestler. And I feel like, again, I'm putting myself over and blowing smoke up our asses, but we've gone from working in front of tiny crowds and earning zero money to having pretty good livings. And we're getting to do it by doing stuff we love and being ourselves. And yeah, I feel like we are. We're moving the business forward. So that, for me, obviously things like having match of the year and being champion is cool, but if I could make my little dent on the wrestling business, that's very important to me as well.
Man, when I got into business, I just wanted to be a wrestler. Mm. I mean, I didn't even think about being a world champion.
Sure.
That wasn't even in the plans.
Really?
I just wanted to be one of the boys. I mean, you know, I wanted to wrestle.
Yeah.
I wanted to be good.
Yeah.
And in my athletic days, playing football, throwing the discus or whatever, I was very competitive. Man, I wanted to be the best. Mm. You know, obviously, you know, wasn't good enough to play pro football, wasn't good enough to do it, but in wrestling business, I took it very seriously. But I just wanted to be one of the boys. Mm. And so, end up, it turned out, have a pretty good run. At any point, now that you've been in the business, you're only 28 years old, mm, going on 29, grizzled veteran in front of me.
Absolutely,
but
you've
been doing this for now 12 years.
Something like that,
12,
yeah.
13, whatever.
Yeah.
So you're a veteran. Mm. So now, do you have a long-term picture or a big-term picture or long-term goals?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where, like I said before, I'm in a really good place in the sense that I absolutely love what I'm doing. I get to be my own boss. I get to travel the world. I get to meet all these different cool people. I get to take in all this different culture. And like I said, make a good living for myself. And not only that, but I get to create this almost persona and character that people can invest in and people can get behind, which I find is super cool. Obviously, I get asked pretty much on a daily basis. Big fans say to me, hey, would you go to WWE? Which I think is such a vague question as well, because if I turn around to you, Steve, and said, hey, Steve, would you do something for money? I'm sure your first two questions would be, well, what is it and how much money? Is this thing, well, would you go to WWE? I mean, obviously that's the big dog. That's the biggest company out there. But like I said, I'm loving what I'm doing now. So never say never. But like I said, my end goal really is just to create, my catchphrase that fans get behind is long live the villain. And that's because I'd like the idea of creating a body of work that's going to surpass me and live for a long time and be remembered long after I'm gone. And people can look back on it and be like, whoa, that was cool. So That's kind of what I want to do. Like I said, it's making that dent in the industry.
We were talking earlier at the house before we started rolling sound, and you was talking about the enjoyment of being on the road and myself expressing how much I love to travel back in the day. What are the your favorite things of being on the road and your worst nightmares of being on the road? Whether it's obnoxious people, people with no manners.
I mean, that's the thing. Actually, when I first spoke to you the other day on the phone, I was having a bit of a hot mess of a day. Well, the thing is with the wrestling now, and because I travel so much, you know, you've got those wrestling priorities. So you get in the hotel, you check in, you wake up in the morning. Okay, I've got to do my laundry. I've got to find a gym. I think for me, like, I'm a big fan of just eating out and, you know, going to these cool restaurants. And still, like, obviously, I still live in the UK. I've been working in the States for a little while now, but it's still quite a big novelty to me being in the United States. Last night, we all went to In-N-Out Burger. That's a big novelty to me. Going to Cracker Barrel, that's a big novelty to me. I enjoy that. But I think just being with the boys and especially with a lot of the guys that I've mentioned previously, we pretty much, all we talk about really is the business, because we love it. We're so passionate about it. And I think the fans can see that in us, and that's why they can get behind us, because they know that we're authentic, we're organic. And
that's good to hear.
Yeah, and that's always, that's why as well, I think that a lot of fans, when I get the odd wrestlers, you know, slightly, so you're a terrible heel, you go out there and you're supposed to be a heel and you get the biggest reaction of the night. And I think, well, I think that's because I'm going out there and just being me and being, you know, the volume's turned up. It's like, do I have a chip on my shoulder? Absolutely. And the fans can see that, and they see how it's organic. It's not fake, because like you said, a lot of the fans, they know the business is a work now, but they can tell if somebody's real or not. And I think that's why the fans get behind us. And, but yeah, going back to you know, on the road, I work the majority in the United States, and I live in the UK, which seems kind of silly. So I'm probably racking up more miles than I'd say I'm in the top five wrestlers in terms of amount of travel done this year. But end of the day, like I said, I grew up in my family had so little money. We never even came out of our village. I always dreamt of this. At the end of the day, the business doesn't owe me anything. So, getting to live this lifestyle, does it suck? You know, being in the airport, my flight's 3 hours delayed, and then have to get on a plane for 12 hours in economy, and I'm sat next to someone. Absolutely. But I've got my freedom. I'm getting to do what I love to do. So, it's all part of it.
Here's what happened. Marty was telling a story, and the application on my phone, doorbell, was going off. Doorbird started ringing. Someone ringing my doorbell. So I got a camera on my phone. It was a delivery guy bringing some rugs over to 316 Gimmick Street. We've been waiting on these rugs for a couple of months. Need a little bit of carpet in there. We got the hardwood floors going, Marty. That's cool. But need a little bit of rug going there for some soundproofing and something to walk on. Anyway, God dang, the villain walks out to the mean streets of Los Angeles, throws a big-ass rug on his shoulders. Two rugs are about 20 feet long. Me and the villain doing work.
God dang,
I didn't expect you to come over and start young boying over here and carry rugs for me, but I appreciate it.
I'm not afraid to get my hands dirty. I'm not afraid of real work. You know,
dude, when you busted out the umbrella, started twirling that thing, I said, oh, hell, he might just try to get some heat on me here. I done put his ass to work.
No. Well, going back to the young boy thing, that was always a thing when I trained, was having that respect for the veterans. And even now, that's like a big thing for me. You joked earlier about me being a grizzled vet, and I don't see myself as that, because I always kind of say, I'm like, I don't really know what I'm doing. I'm just acting silly. If people get behind it, cool. I don't know all the rules. I don't know the answers. But I've always, that etiquette and that respect, I think, has always got to be there. So even guys that I consider super good, you know, good friends now, guys like Colt Cabana or Doug Williams and these guys that I came through the business with, or, you know, looked up to, even now, even though we're, you know, good mates, I'll say, yeah, you take the front seat. You order your food first. Let me give you a hand. You know, oh, I'll save this space for Carl. I'll do this. And I think you need that in the business, right?
Right.
I think so. So, I mean, obviously, you've got a bit more tenure on me, Steve, in the business. So,
He saw my old ass shoulder, that heavy ass rug, and said, I can't let this broken down piece of trash carry this rug. I had sympathy from the villain. He just begged me, he said, Steve, you gotta let me help you.
I was ready to take both of them, Steve. Come on,
I thought the villain was gonna start crying. I started handing some damn napkins and stuff. Don't lose it, I'm cool. Hell, I went in, and Marty was over there. I busted out both my leg braces, got my BMF vest. He's like, holy smokes, what's going on here? Marty, I got work to do. Hey, where do you want to go from here? What do you want to talk about? Hey, I want to talk about when you were hosting that, I guess it turned into a YouTube channel called Wrestle Talk.
Yeah.
How'd that all start? You just a talkative, chatty guy? Good communication skills? You said you went back to university. What'd you get a degree in?
So I kind of was in and out of education for many years because obviously all I ever wanted to do was wrestle. So when someone says, okay, well, you've actually got to go out there and earn money, what do you want to do? So, I want to be a wrestler. But obviously, at the same time, you got to pay the bills. And so I remember I'd got to the point where I was wrestling every weekend. But dude, there were some points when I was so skinned, like I wasn't making crap, you know. For example, I would go, let's say I had a weekend of shows, I'd go to the petrol station, gas station, I'd fill up my car with fuel, I'd go to pay for it, and my card would be declined because I had no money in. So, but obviously, fortunately, the fuel's already in there, so they would take my card or my passport or whatever, I'd have to go away, do the weekend of shows, and I'd have enough money to come back and you know, pay the gas back. And it was like that for a long time, because like I said, the British wrestling scene kind of came from nothing. So for many, many years, I didn't make, you know, again, I made enough to get by. And it was, you know, Tesco value food here, and you'd get cut corners. And you joked to me earlier about how back in the day you were pretty frugal and tight, and how Owen Hart used to ride with Marks. But I remember we used to be on the touring holiday camps, and if we didn't have accommodation for the night, we would go and stay at the fans' houses sometimes. I used to quite like it because you'd stay there. It was either a case of you could have a shoddy hotel or you go stay at the fans' house and they'd do your laundry, which, you know, would be marvelous. Yeah. They'd cook you a nice meal, which will save you a few quid. So I used to enjoy that. But like I said, I didn't have much money. But anyway, for the most part, I'd only wrestle at the weekend. So I thought, you know what? I'm not doing anything during the week. I was like, maybe I should get another job and do something. So again, I've always been I'm not afraid of real work. I just showed that with my excellent skills carrying the rugs. But I just hate the idea of doing something I don't like just for money. I hate that concept. I don't understand the idea.
Millions of people around the world are doing that.
97%. And I don't want to live. I don't want to live to work and work to live. That's just my idea of hell. And I think as well, that was, as I was growing up, my parents were very much like, oh, okay, you should get a job and you should get a trade. And they were trying to point me in the direction of being a plumber. I said, you should be a plumber, Marty. It's a good trade. And that's, you know, you get that behind you, you can make good money. And I said, yeah, but I don't want to be a plumber. Why would I do that? And there's that famous Jim Carrey quote when he says, you can fail at something you don't like, so you got to try, you know, something you do. So anyway, I'm rambling, but so I wasn't making much money. I thought, okay, during the week, all this time off during the week, I need to do something. And I thought, well, you know what? I never actually studied. Like, I would quite like to get a degree, and I'm relatively intelligent. And back in the day when I was a kid and I couldn't concentrate, I couldn't have done it then, but I was a little bit older. So I started university maybe when I was 22, I want to say. So I got my degree in marketing and media, and there's a bit of journalism in there and stuff like that as well. So it was cool. I enjoyed it, and it's super nice to have that thing to fall back on, I think. And I never really intend on falling back on it, touch wood. But just even going to university is just a good life experience anyway. And I think just...
Has it helped you in your pro wrestling endeavors?
I can't say it has. Maybe it has, though. I don't know. Again, I think more of anything, just the life experience as well. I left school, and the first thing I did, my family pointed me in the direction of this concrete factory. We would make, and I was part of the carpentry department, where we would make the wooden molds for stairs. So we would cut them up and everything else. And I was a 16-year-old boy, and I'm working, you know, 9 to 6 doing this carpentry job. And I was a 16-year-old boy, and I was quite a young 16 as well, because I was training the rest of the weekends, but I was working with all these middle-aged men. And I just thought, I did that for a while. And I'd wake up in the morning, and I would honestly have a nausea feeling, like, oh, not again, not again. I'm doing this for money, right? I don't want to be there. And I just remember thinking, like, I'm a 16-year-old boy. Like, I should be out there with young people. I should be doing cool things. Like, I don't want to be here with middle-aged men doing something that I hate. And I was like, what am I doing with myself? And I had that escape at the weekends because I was going to the wrestling school and training. But, yeah, I just knew that that wasn't the life for me. I end up, I quit maybe after a few months and, yeah, that certainly wasn't me. But so that's when, after that is when I decided I needed to go back to, I went studying in college. And then after that, again, I got another job, which I decided, no, this is not for me. Went to university, got that degree. But like I said, with that marketing degree, obviously I had to learn how to write, which was kind of cool. So I had to write a lot of dissertations and stuff, which maybe 50,000 words, some sort of journalistic pieces. So even then I would get into, every now and then a wrestling magazine would, or a newspaper might contact me to write a piece about wrestling, because obviously I was a wrestler. And that kind of, going back to what you said, kind of tied into the wrestling show on TV. It was actually on a pretty big channel, Challenge in the UK, run by, the show was run by a guy called Alex Shane. And it was just a weekly kind of magazine chat about wrestling show. And I'd been on the show a few times as a guest. And I just said, hey, if there's any other chance to do anything more, you know, I'm up for it, because it's another trade. It's presenting. It's not something that I'm... It's one of those things where I like it a lot. I wouldn't say I was super duper passionate about it, but I did enjoy it. So getting the opportunity to do it was awesome. I think that was the wrestling. I love it when people say, oh, I really want to be a wrestler. It's like, well, if you're not doing it, you don't really want to be a wrestler. You just like the idea of being a wrestler. Like me, a lot of the times I think, oh, I'd love to be an actor. It's like, well, I loved it that much. I'd be, you know, I'd be living out here doing it. You know what I mean? But maybe it's something you look at in the future. But yeah, I did quite a bit of TV work back in the day, and I've done more recently I've done some commercials and everything else. And again, it's just kind of like a conversation we had earlier, just building that brand and having more, giving yourself a platform for more people to see you on, having more trades as such, because like we know you can't wrestle forever, but the first and foremost for me it's the wrestling. That's my priority. The other stuff's nice, but the wrestling's my real passion, my real love, you know. So
all right, Marty, before we wrap this thing up, 28 years old, been in the business a decade, more than a decade.
Yeah.
The Villain. How are you feeling from my physical standpoint?
I feel great. Touch wood. In this, the state of wrestling right now, obviously, it gets a lot of critique for being very high impact and a lot of risk. Somehow, I've managed to not take as many risks, I think, as everyone else. My approach to the wrestling is to try and be as different as I can be and try and stand out. And I can't do as many cool flips as a lot of the other guys, like a Will Ospreay or a Ricochet. So everything I do, it's just to be different. As soon as I see something that someone does similar to me, if it's a move or whatever it is, I switch it up, I change it, because I know the way for me to stand out and be recognized is to be different. And I think a lot of wrestling these days, a lot of wrestlers have a tendency to be lazy. And I don't mean in the ring, everyone works hard. I think they have a tendency to be lazy in the creative department. So, for example, in the independent circuit now, a lot of big moves are used, and things like Canadian Destroyers are used by a lot of different people because they know those moves are going to get a pop. You know, chances are they'll get a pop. And I think that to me is lazy, because doing something that you know is going to get a pop, you're not working for that. You're just kind of reciting old stuff. And that's not...
You're throwing it out there because it's going to get a pop.
Right, and that's not a risk.
If there's a reason for it and it belongs, then you're going to get more of a pop and it works for the match, for the story.
Yeah, and I think as well, I think the creative satisfaction I get is taking a risk, something that's not been done before, and seeing if I can get that over. Does that make sense?
Yep.
Yeah, so like I'll do a lot of stuff and think, this is a little bit outside the box. This might not get over. Like my finishing move is the crossface chicken wing, and I essentially decided to do it because I turned heel, and I thought, okay, what's the most boring finishing move I can think of? Everyone's doing flashy moves. I'm gonna do the most boring move. And I remember back in the British wrestling, guys like Marty Jones would use the chicken wing, and Johnny Kidd, who were some of my favorites. And I thought, no one does that anymore. It's not very flashy. Let's do in a world of everyone's landing on their heads, getting bumped on the apron, doing these crazy dives, I'm going to do a crossface chicken wing, and hopefully people will boo the hell out of me. Unfortunately, people thought it was so brilliant. It's now the highlight of my matches, and people go nuts, and I'm selling a bunch of t-shirts that say chicken wing on them. So it's just one of those things. But it's just daring to be different. It's taking those risks. When Colt Cabana, I've mentioned him a couple of times, he said to me years ago when I started coming to the ring with a fur coat and umbre, he said, "You're ridiculous." He goes, "What, you look so stupid." And I said, "Listen," I go, "I'm going to see how it goes." And sure enough, it's the biggest part of my act to the point. I sold all my umbrellas on eBay the other day for, the equivalent in dollars was $2,600 for an umbrella. We put the Marty Scurll umbrellas on Pro Wrestling Tees, and they sold out in 3 hours and they crashed the website, and that's a big part of my gimmick. And again, like I said before, it was a rib, but it's that risk to do something, you know what I mean? It's do something different, and that's what this business, in my opinion, that's what it needs. You need to take risks, we need to step out of comfort zones, and we need to think outside the box, because the fans have seen so much, they've seen everything, so you need to go out there and deliver something different and give them something they haven't seen before. That's why I fell in love with wrestling back in the day, because it was so exciting and I didn't know what was going to happen, and that excitement, I think it can get lost if it's strictly just about big moves in a match, you know what I mean? So for me, it's all about trying to be as different and trying to stand out as much as I possibly can.
Last thing, who came up, or how, when did you come up with this?
I honestly, with you, Austin,
I'm flapping my wings right now. This is the podcast. No one can see me. I'm flapping my wings.
You are. It was a lovely impression.
How was that, by the way?
That was pretty good. That was a pretty good, actually. That was...
I mean, I didn't stretch it. I could have blown a rotator cuff.
So, I feel like I don't want to say that I have no... shame, but
I have no shame.
No, that's not the right word. I'm not afraid of being, my friends will tell you this, I'm not afraid of being embarrassed. Okay, I spent all those years and years ago wrestling on a holiday camps a lot, right? And on those holiday camps there weren't wrestling fans, and quite often you would go out there and no matter what you did you would get zero. Sometimes it was a complete opposite and the crowd would go nuts, okay? But a lot of times you'd go out there and you do stuff, you give them what you think they want, and they would just be sitting on your hands. And I've wrestled in front of 8 people and it's been silence, and I'm standing there in my spandex pants, and it's pretty embarrassing, and you have to get over yourself. You got to leave your ego at the door. You can't be embarrassed, okay? So any embarrassment for me has completely gone. So now I can come to the ring and I can do pretty much anything I want, because even if it doesn't get over, I'm okay with that. That's fine. So I can imagine it's much the same as, I've got many friends who are stand-up comedians. Sure, it's the same thing. They do years and years and years doing jokes that just don't get over, and they just learn to, like, I know you have that feeling, so I'm like, oh, and even sometimes now I'll be in a ring and I think of some idea and I'm like, well, we've got to try it, we've got to do it, we'll do it. Like I said, these days I'm a bit more tenured. 90% of the time it's probably going to get over. There's sometimes it doesn't. I just look at the guy and I can't help but laugh. I wrestled a few months ago, I wrestled Mr. Kennedy. Mr. Anderson, and I don't think I'd ever met him before, and we didn't really go through anything, and we went out there, and we pretty much tore the house down. We both did some mic work, and we went back and forth doing his gimmick, being the arsehole, me being the villain, and we were trying to out-cheat each other, all this stuff, and we did it in Ring of Honor as well, which is real cool, because it's a company known for its, in-ring, and we were just doing all these shenanigans, and Shakespeare, whatever you want to call it. Anyway, the finish, I'm supposed to grab him and I give him a small package. I grab him, hook him. So I'm trying to pull him forward. I grab him. I hook my leg. He starts falling backwards. Like, he made this small package look like shit. And I'm just pissing myself laughing. I'm just like, it's the finish of the match. And we're in it. And we're just both, I'm just pissing myself laughing because it was so funny because, we worked our asses off and had this great match. And then it's like, boom. But like, I don't care about things like that. I don't care about messing up. That's, to me, it can be funny. Same as I'll do something in the ring sometimes and it will get silent. Especially in some of the country towns in Japan, you'll do something to complete silence. And there's a part of you that goes, I cringe. But again, as I was saying before, you have to have those moments to be willing to take risks. So I'm pretty sure the arm thing, I'm pretty sure it's one of those things where I was in a match, I was acting like an idiot, trying to, hot dog to the crowd or whatever. For years, make eye contact with someone in the crowd and then just give it a, shake my hips or, throw my crutch at them or whatever, or give them a wink or whatever it is. Or, and then one take, maybe tie up, clean break. And it's like, oh, I'm going to flap my, I don't know why I do it, Steve. But I did it. And then the fans started doing it. And then it's like, oh, he's the man that flaps his wings. Coco Beware did it back in the day. A lot of my influences, Doink the Clown, Evil Doink back in the day, big influence on me.
He was amazing. A lot of people look past it. They just think, hey, it was a clown gimmick. Yeah. Hey, no, man. Matt Bourne is Doink. It was awesome.
It was awesome. It took a little bit from him, took a little bit from Bob Backlund, took a little bit from Coco Beware, but these are the wrestlers people aren't taking their stuff from. So, again, it's going to be different. But, yeah, like I said, that was just, I don't know, just took a life of his own. If you look at wrestling too hard, if you take wrestling too seriously, you might say, hey, how does this make sense? What is that in the psychology? And they're right, but I think you can make a reason for anything. But the fact is, when I do it, it's over as hell, and the whole crowds do it. And even in Japan, where they normally sit very reserved, right, I'd come out and do this, and the whole crowd are doing, I'm flapping my arms now as I'm talking to Steve Austin. it's just one of those things. I'd always say, think of Austin, you think of the arm raising the finger, and you think of the Undertaker, the eyes raised. I guess my now is the arm flap thing, and it doesn't matter what it is as long as there's something. So that's where the arm flap. I think a lot of people think it's because of the chicken wing, and I wear that bird mask. So, like, a lot of the interviews in Japan, when you translate it, it would say, like, oh, the mysterious bird gentleman from England, which I think, I guess I'm a mysterious bird man now, I guess.
Anything you want to plug before we ride off in the sunset?
Yeah, so you can buy my t-shirts, and like we said before, in Hot Topic now, so that would be great. They've been selling out everywhere, which is awesome. And they said, I just literally received an email a minute ago, if the shirts sell really well, then we'll get the Pop Funko figures of us as well. So this is going to be groundbreaking stuff for the independent wrestlers. So obviously I can't thank the people's support enough. So yeah, the shirts are there, and obviously you can buy them from prowrestlingtees.com/Marty Scurll. You can even pick up a Marty Scurll umbrella. There we go.
And what about one more time, Twitter and Instagram?
Yes, it's at Marty Scurll on the Twitter, and at Marty Scurll on the Instagram. I actually as well just started a UK store, because many of the fans in the UK were getting upset paying those postage fees. So it's my website at the moment. I think we're going to change the name eventually, but it's portraitofawrestler.com/villain-enterprises. That's my it's a bit like 316 Gimmick Street. It's Villain Enterprises.
God dang, Einstein equals MC squared. The complex web address. But if you missed it, back it up and let's do it again.
If you go on my Twitter, it's my pinned tweet at the top. There we go.
And that's the bottom line, because the villain said so. All right, everybody, give me the go-home cue. It's time to wrap up the podcast and ride off in the sunset. Before I do that, I want to thank my guest, Marty Scurll, for coming by 317 Gimmick Street.
New Japan Pro Wrestling was in town right before he hit the airport. Marty Scurll came by with his umbrella and his luggage, stopped by, and we cut a podcast. Marty, next time you come to Los Angeles, look me up. I'll buy you a beer or have a glass of whiskey with you or do another podcast. Your call. I got a match for you guys to watch. This match is from Ring of Honor. It's a TV championship match featuring Marty Scurll versus Juice Robinson. Juice Robinson is another guy I was impressed with at the Long Beach shows. He worked a match the first night with Zack Sabre Jr., a technical wizard, and it was a damn good match, one of my favorites of the night. So check out Ring of Honor TV Championship match, Marty Scurll versus Juice Robinson from January 2017. One of the things I really liked about this match is this was a Ring of Honor TV match. It's an 8-minute and 25-second match, and from what I saw on YouTube. And what I liked about it was they didn't try to put 10 pounds of stuff in a 5-pound bag. Worked at a good pace, sold, told a solid story, hit the go-home cue, end of story, damn good match. Two pros out there, and you know, I know Juice Robinson ain't been around forever. Marty Scurll is a seasoned veteran, but a real good match, and the future's bright for both these guys. Hell of a match, check it out. Hey, there's a new season of Broken Skull Challenge. We're going to start production in less than 2 weeks, and that means I'm going to have a bunch of brand-new badass T-shirts coming to ProWrestlingTees.com/Steve Austin. And as far as beer goes, if you're thirsty and you love IPAs, I just happen to have the best IPA on the planet, Steve Austin's Broken Skull IPA from El Segundo Brewing Company. Pick it up at Whole Foods and Total Wines if you live in Cali, or order it from InsideTheCellar.com if you live in a state they ship to. And I got one more thing to tell you about. I got my own page at Amazon, and that's where you can find the Cold Steel Broken Skull Knife and the new Working Man Knife. Just go to Amazon.com/shop/Steve Austin. You can also find me on Twitter and Instagram at Steve Austin BSR. And thanks for supporting all the fine sponsors of the Steve Austin Show. That's how I'm able to do this podcast for you twice a week for free. And you can find all my sponsors at podcastone.com. Just click on the Killer Deals button at the top of the page and then click on the Steve Austin Show banner. Folks, coming up on Thursday, it will be my good friend, Jumpin' Jim Ross, the white meat babyface from Norman, Oklahoma. Hey, folks, the 60-second AP News headlines are coming up next. Until then, my name is Steve Austin, and I will catch your ass down the road.
Thanks for listening to The Steve Austin Show. Check out new episodes every Tuesday on the Podcast One app or subscribe at Apple Podcasts or PodcastOne.com.